A month ago, the hapless New York Knicks were winning, hapless and Carmelo-less. Their star forward, Carmelo Anthony, was hurt, but coach Mike D'Antoni had found point guard Jeremy Lin at the end of the bench. D'Antoni inserted Lin into the lineup, and Lin's sanity ensued. D'Antoni looked like a genius, or at least he didn't look like the beleaguered coach of a team going nowhere. Now, Anthony has returned, and since that time, the Knicks have gone 3-9. Yesterday, in the midst of this implosion, Coach D'Antoni resigned. Howard Beck covers the Knicks for the New York Times, and Howard Beck, what happened?
That's a good question. I think we're all still trying to come to grips with what happened, because it was very sudden. I think the best way to sum it up is that, you know, you had a coach, Mike D'Antoni, who had a system that he very much believed in, that he has succeeded with, that he's run for most of his NBA career, and had found the point guard who fit it in Jeremy Lin. And what he didn't have was a franchise star who bought into that system. And so Mike D'Antoni concluded that what was best for him, what was best for Carmelo Anthony, and what was best for the Knicks was for different leadership.
But why didn't the Knicks ownership take note of the fact that when D'Antoni's system was in place, and when Jeremy Lin was the star player in that system for several games, they were winning. The Knicks were winning.
Yeah, and I think everybody, certainly top management at Madison Square Garden, enjoyed and reaped all the benefits of Lin's sanity. But ultimately, this franchise had already invested a great deal in Carmelo Anthony. When it comes right down to it, Carmelo Anthony is still the face of this franchise, and that wasn't going to change. And Mike D'Antoni's last request yesterday before he ultimately resigned was, look, will you at least consider trading Carmelo Anthony? And when the answer was no, that pretty much cinched the decision.
What we're talking about here really is, should the offense of the New York Knicks involve finding the open man and not having one go-to guy, or should it involve Carmelo Anthony having the ball, getting free, and taking a lot of shots?
That's, you know, it's the simple way of putting it, and it's pretty much the what it came down to. Carmelo Anthony's not a bad guy, and he's not necessarily a selfish guy. He's a guy who's had every team he's ever been on catered to his skill set and to his desire to have the ball in his hands a lot and to create scoring chances mostly for himself.
Looking ahead to the end of the season, I guess, one thing we know is Carmelo Anthony is staying. The Knicks need a new coach. Do they have much of a chance of going far in the playoffs or getting into the playoffs at all?
I think it's going to be an uphill battle for them right now. You know, they're hovering in that eighth spot with the Milwaukee Bucks coming up on them. And the Knicks' schedule the rest of the way is really, really tough. They may have a tough time.
Well, Howard Beck, thanks for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
So Howard Beck, who covers the New York Knicks for the New York Times.
Steve Martin is still finding new ways to make people laugh. 40 years on stage, on record albums, on the big and small screens, sometimes playing his banjo, the comedian is now on Twitter with nearly 2.5 million followers. And his funny, slightly demented Twitter feed has gone old school, collected on paper in a book, where many of the biggest laughs come from his followers' responses. When Steve Martin came into our studio, he was carrying his banjo and quick to admit that before he started tweeting in 2010, he was skeptical.
I was actually talking to a friend of mine, Tom Hanks, and he was tweeting. And I said, why do you do that? Because I had this perception of tweeting that it was very low. And he said, well, I use it actually for a promotion. I talk about the movie I'm doing, and I sometimes tweet photos, and it builds awareness. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I was growing frustrated that when you do a movie or a record that you have to promote it. So I was going on television. You know, I was playing to an audience of 4 million, for example, and maybe only 400 of them were actually interested in my so-called product. And I thought, well, if I had a Twitter feed, you know, and say I had a followers of 100,000, that means 100,000 of them would be interested in my book, let's say.
Which is logical.
It was logical, but it didn't turn out to be true. It turned out if I had a Twitter feed of 100,000, 4 of them were interested in my book. So
it's proportional,
yeah.
It turned out to be.
So now I have a following of almost 2.5 million, And it turns out that tweeting is really only good for one thing. It's just good for tweeting.
When you first started, you were doing a series, sort of it seems like, so something like a monologue on Twitter. I mean, there's one of these, starts with this nice saying, a watched iPhone never syncs.
I did a little series there. It's, you know, my iPhone is now lip syncing. And iPhone just synced perfectly with Toaster.
Well, at what point were you at when you got to the, it's almost like a riff on jury duty?
This was inspired by, you know, I was actually called for jury duty, like the third time in, seemed like 3 months. I started pretending as though I were at jury duty. And I think the first tweet was, report from jury duty, defendant looks like a murderer, guilty, waiting for opening remarks.
It goes on, and you're commenting on the other jurors. Other jurors are stupid.
Well, yes, report from jury duty. Other jurors are stupid. They don't believe in hexes. Plus, they want me to put my magazines away. What I started to find was that when people started responding, I found they were really writing well. I remember running into my wife a couple of times and reading some of the responses, and we were laughing out loud, like, oh, yes. My tweet was, this was, I was promoting my album, Rare Bird Alert, and I tweeted, Rare Bird Alert, number 3 on Amazon. I'm happy as a clam. Wait, are clams really happy? And a responder said, the chilling sound of clam laughter has caused many fishermen to quit the sea.
That's pure poetry. Why do you think people seem to be funnier in their tweets than they would ever be on comments on blogs and such?
I agree. And that's another thing I found. I felt like I was looking at kind of a new form of comedy in a strange way, that was talking and response and talking and response in a written way. There's some of it being left just kind of looking at.
Well, there's a whole riff on your caps lock key.
Yes, it was the premise that my caps lock key was talking to the audience when I was away.
And so everything's in uppercase.
Yeah, it was, hi, I'm Steve's caps lock key. It's all in caps. And I'd like to meet other caps locks keys. I'm interested in boating and hiking. And then a guy wrote back in lowercase, your kind are not welcome here.
Yeah. It is you have gained these comedic collaborators.
Yes, and I've always believed that there are funny people everywhere, but they're just not comedians. In fact, some of my best comedic inspirations were not professional entertainers. You know, I had a friend in Texas, and his wife told me they were at an amusement park. And they came up to one of those maps, and it had a map of the amusement park, and it said, you are here. And he looked at it, and he said to her, how does it know?
Do you, it does seem like there was a random thought that would lead to a theme. And as the book goes along, it just often seems like totally random thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like finally thinking about getting a computer.
Yes. I like the absurdity of that, that you can't possibly be tweeting and finally be thinking about getting a computer. And then people immediately catch on to it. You know, I like the idea that one thing leads to another. You can tweet something completely innocuous and then find yourself going off on a tangent that's inspired by a response. And, you know, these things appear on people's phones in the middle of the day. You know, it's not like people are gathered in a hall and they're expecting something funny. You know, talk about the unexpected.
Which is one of the key elements.
It's a good thing, yeah.
Of comedy.
And there's absolutely no reward but it.
But it's rewarding.
It is rewarding because it's just its own reward. It's sort of like heaven.
The book is The 10 Make That 9 Habits of Very Organized People. Make That 10. The tweets of Steve Martin. And remember the banjo he brought in? After we chatted, he picked it up and played a new song for us, the song that you're hearing right now, which he may or may not be playing when his band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, goes on the road. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You don't need a telescope or even a super dark night sky to be able to enjoy a gorgeous planetary tango going on right now. Venus and Jupiter are both really bright and really close together in the sky. You owe it to yourself to go out and take a good look. Here to help is Kelly Beatty with Sky and Telescope magazine. And Kelly, I've been going out every night to take a look at this. Tell folks where they can see these planets and when the best time is.
Boy, you almost have to work hard to miss it. You need to look in the west, in the general area where sunset is, as soon as it gets dark, maybe even before it gets dark, and unmistakably you'll see these two bright stars lingering in the sky about halfway up. The brighter one is Venus, and the other one, its partner, is Jupiter.
And how bright? When you say they're bright, they are really bright. How bright are they?
They are brighter than any other star in the sky. The only thing that outshines them in the night sky is the moon. And you know, the moon's not in the sky, so there's no competition there.
And they've been gliding past each other. Which one is now higher?
Well, right now, Venus is the one a little bit higher up in the sky. It's on the upper right. Jupiter is down to its lower left. And as you watch them night by night, they've been sliding past each other. Jupiter is actually headed down. In another month, it'll be very, very difficult to see, but Venus will still be there. And in fact, Venus is about as high as it ever gets in the sky right now. And so we'll have it with us for quite a long time.
This, I understand, was an important observation for Galileo. Explain that.
Oh, well, if you have a telescope of any size, take a look at Venus, the brighter one, and you'll see that it's the shape of a football. Now, week by week, it will mimic the phases of the moon and will become a thin crescent. When Galileo realized that Venus goes through a full cycle of phases, like the moon does, it cemented the idea that Venus goes around the sun and not the Earth, and that was the beginning of the end for an Earth-centered universe.
Hmm. How long each night, Kelly, can folks find Venus and Jupiter in the sky?
Well, the nice thing is that, you know, last year they were close together as well, but it was low in the sky just before dawn. This is a special time because the two will be hanging together in the sky for several hours after sunset. So even if you can't rush right out or if you got a little bit of cloud passing by, they will be together until, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And it won't be just tonight. Over the next few days, in fact, a few weeks, you'll be able to see them together in the sky.
And pretty soon the moon's going to make an appearance up there with them too?
Oh, I need you all to mark your calendars for the 25th and 26th, because a crescent moon will join the dance. A thin crescent moon, no thicker than a fingernail, will be edging its way up from the western horizon. It'll pass very close to Jupiter on March 25th, and next to Venus the next night on the 26th. There'll be three players on the stage at this one time.
Okay, I'm marking my calendar right now. One more thing, Kelly, because not to be outdone, Mars, which to my eye, with no telescope or anything, is distinctly kind of orange up in the sky.
It is. And, you know, they call Mars the red planet because its rocks are rusty, and that red color is really evident to the eye. So if you time this just right, if you look to the west, just as Jupiter and Venus are setting in the west, Mars is high up in the southeast, and Saturn is just rising over the eastern horizon. You can take in all four at one time.
Okay, it's a lot to do. Thanks for helping us out, Kelly.
My pleasure, Melissa. Thanks.
That's Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope magazine.
In France, far-right politics and anti-Muslim mudslinging have crept onto center stage ahead of next month's presidential election. France may be in the midst of an economic crisis, but it is halal meat that has become the unlikely and controversial focus of the campaign, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
It all began when National Front Party presidential candidate Marine Le Pen said that non-Muslims in Paris were unwittingly eating halal meat.
En poursuivant notre enquête, c'est ce que nous avons découvert.
Her comments came a few days after a television exposé on the French meat industry. The report on popular investigative show Envoyé Spécial focused on sanitary conditions at France's 275 slaughterhouses. But it also delved into the issue of ritual slaughter. Though a European law mandates that animals be stunned unconscious before being killed, there is an exception for religious slaughter where the animal's throat is slit while it's still conscious. The television documentary reported that most abattoirs around Paris practice only halal slaughter methods because it's too expensive to do both, and they don't want to miss out on the large Muslim market in and around the French capital.
Disons que déjà, ils s'attendent pas à avoir une boucherie traditionnelle de la viande halal.
This traditional French butcher in the documentary, Jacques Pierre, explains that he doesn't tell his customers that they're eating halal meat. We have to lie to them, he says. We have no choice. Marine Le Pen says French customs are being crushed by an invading immigrant force.
Moi, j'ai le droit, comme citoyenne, comme consommatrice,
I have the right as a citizen to know if I'm buying meat where the animal is slaughtered in horrible cruelty, taking sometimes 15 minutes to die. This is a moral point. Don't French people who don't want to eat halal have the same rights as Muslims who do?
At the Oasis Halal meat shop in this largely immigrant neighborhood in the north of Paris, four butchers stand behind the counter waiting on a line of customers. The butchers say every time there's an election, Muslims are stigmatized, whether it's halal meat or headscarves. Buying lamb chops, French Algerian Karim Ben Hadada says he's long stopped paying attention to Marine Le Pen and the National Front Party.
Ils ont un problème avec les musulmans. C'est dans leur cœur. Ils ont de la haine.
The latest debate has nothing to do with halal meat. It's that their hearts are full of hatred towards us.
Outside his office in central Paris, Jean-Yves Camus, expert on the far right with the Institute of International and Strategic Relations, says the issue of eating halal or not is of no particular interest to most French people.
Well, in fact, it's not really a debate within the French population at all. The only thing the average Frenchman is aware is that Muslims eat a kind of meat which is not the same as the one he eats, but he only cares about the price of the meat.
It all might have fizzled out, but President Nicolas Sarkozy, who is trailing socialist frontrunner François Hollande, is desperate to attract voters from the far right. Not to be outdone by Le Pen, Sarkozy called for stricter meat labeling and reiterated his position that serving halal meat in school cafeterias was a contradiction of French secular values. Then Sarkozy's prime minister really stuck his foot in it.
Au maintien de traditions qui n'ont plus grand-chose à voir.
Speaking on Europe One Radio, François Fillon suggested that Muslim and Jewish ancestral ritual slaughter traditions were outdated. Fillon said, religions should think about continuing to keep traditions that don't have much in common with today's state of science or hygiene. His comments brought French Muslims and Jews together in a rare show of unity. The gaffe may also have alienated some French Jews who have long supported Sarkozy. Fillon has been meeting with rabbis and imams, scrambling to repair the damage. Camus says the debate shows the battle for the French presidency is being waged on the far right.
If you want to be a real leader of the right, you have, at one point, to take away those voters from the National Front and drag them into your own party, which is the UMP, Sarkozy's party.
This time around, Camus says Sarkozy has failed to attract those voters, and his leap into the ritual slaughter debate shows just how desperate he is, less than 2 months away from the presidential election. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. A Goldman Sachs executive who quit his job yesterday joins a proud tradition. Greg Smith wrote an op-ed in the New York Times slamming the financial firm where he worked for years.
He claimed they didn't even pretend to care about their clients anymore and talked only of how to make money from the clients. The Times was so impressed it wrote a news article about the significance of its own op-ed attack on Wall Street culture.
Other people soon wrote parodies, including Why I Quit the Empire, written by Darth Vader.
New York Magazine wrote of past financial industry flameouts, like the executive who wrote that he was leaving Wall Street and went on to endorse hemp. Then there was Jake DeSantis, who ripped AIG as he departed, also with an article in the New York Times. NPR's Chris Arnold reports there's a history of people telling their employers to take this job and...
There's something fascinating about people who don't just quit, but who go out the door in some kind of grand style. A personal favorite is a disgruntled grocery store worker in Seattle who wrote, "I quit" in Cheese Whiz on the customer service window before leaving. And at the top of any list of recent job quits has to be the JetBlue airline steward, Stephen Slater.
The flight attendant who had a major meltdown is out on bail this morning.
After 28 years as a flight attendant, Slater gained folk hero status in the summer of 2010. After a flight with some difficult passengers, at least according to Slater's version of events, Slater loudly quit his job over the plane's intercom, using the F word many times, then grabbed a beer and went down the plane's emergency exit slide.
Stephen Slater walked out of a New York City lockup to a crush of photographers.
You gonna lose your job?
More than likely.
Slater's grand exit was picked up by all the news networks. There were countless internet tributes, some of them musical.
So he commandeered and grabbed a beer and spoke his mind. Yeah, he flipped the latch and out the hatch and down the slide.
For some reason, there is definitely an element of the heroic in dramatic job quits. That someone is willing to sacrifice their future job prospects for the glory of the moment. Although, in the case of the Goldman Sachs executive Greg Smith, given his pay scale, he probably doesn't need to find another job right away.
This is kind of pure id.
Ben Dattner is an organizational psychologist and the founder of Dattner Consulting, which works with major companies on executive coaching and culture change. He says there is a vicarious thrill about watching somebody else give in to the desire to do something that we know we shouldn't do.
The desire for revenge, the desire for public retribution, without thinking more rationally about what are the consequences for me and for my career.
In the Goldman case, the company said it will examine claims by former employee Greg Smith that executives, quote, callously talk about ripping off their clients. Dattner says Goldman probably should do some self-examination.
Perhaps there's also something for Goldman to learn about an employee who was pushed to the breaking point.
In recent years, some employees' over-the-edge moments have been captured on tape and then posted on YouTube. One hotel worker in Providence, Rhode Island, named Joey, snuck in members of his ragtag-looking brass band to the hotel, and they played a surprise protest march to his boss when he quit his job.
Guys, all of you out right now.
Jared, I'm here to tell you that I'm quitting.
And there was a DJ at the Gulf Coast radio station WBLX. She went by the name Inetta the Mood Setta. She had had enough, too, and quit on the air.
For the last 6 years, I made $6 an hour. That ain't nothing. But Inetta will not be setting the mood at BLX no more.
Chris Arnold, happily employed at NPR News.
I can't take it. I'm not going to take it. I don't have to take it. I'm not a dummy. I know how to find another job, but I refuse to walk around.